So we're going to get started. I just asked Rabbi Soloveitchik to update his bio, so he wrote exactly what I should say. I'll give a very brief introduction. Rabbi Soloveitchik is the assistant rabbi at Congregation Kilat Jeshurun in Manhattan, and is a doctoral student in philosophy of religion at Princeton. That's what he wrote. I'll just tell you what I want to say. I think what we're interested in is honesty and engaging some of the thorny issues of Judaism today. And Rabbi Soloveitchik, his name brings a certain reverence. I had the good fortune of being in the Rav Shir the last year that he gave Shir at Yeshiva University. And there's no figure who influenced my thinking. And the name Soloveitchik, I think, is brings with it great reverence and certainly an image of engaging subjects with honesty and great scholarship. And Rabbi Soloveitchik, who is with us today, has done that. In many of the articles that he's written, he's taken on difficult issues, the article on hate, difficult issues with great scholarship, and more importantly, with honesty and the willingness to grapple with difficult subjects with scholarship and with forthrightness and with honesty. It's a pleasure to have Rabbi Soloveitchik with us.
Thank you very much. Is this on now? Do I speak into this one or this one? Just this one? Anybody hear? Everybody hear me? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Of all the halakhic conundrums that modern-day poskim, modern-day decisors of Jewish law have struggled with, none have been so puzzling as the following. What bracha does one say on Crispix cereal? Okay? Now allow me to explain. You see, the basic rule is that when one is eating a culinary concoction, which has diverse ingredients, then one says a bracha, diverse ingredients demanding different brachot, then one says a blessing on whatever ingredient is in the majority. You have a soup made out of rice and tomatoes. Tomatoes is hadama, rice is mizonos. If rice is the majority, you would say a mizonos. However, if people here are familiar with Crispix cereal, you'll know that in every piece of Crispix cereal, one is confronted by what appears to be a piece of cereal that is exactly 50% corn, hadama, and 50% rice, mizonos. So what bracha does one say? So my father, when he was giving shiurim on the laws of brachot, was very interested in this question, and he called up General Mills or Kellogg's, whatever, and when the operator answered, he said that he was calling to find out whether it was true that the volume, as far as ingredients are concerned, in Crispix cereal is exactly 50% corn and 50% rice. So the operator said, well, if you don't mind my asking, sir, why do you care? So my father explained that he's a rabbi and he was interested in the laws of blessings, and he was trying to figure out whether a Jew who is eating Crispix has to say a blessing on the corn or on the rice. So the operator said, oh, I'm sorry. He was instantly apologetic and got up, put my father on hold for a second, and then comes back online and she says, okay, rabbi, here's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to split the piece of Crispix in half and say one blessing on the corn and one blessing on the rice. So my father was a bit taken aback to have received a psak halacha from the operator at General Mills, but apparently the operator had just gone to ask the local mashkiach who had paskin the shaila himself. Now this example is quite relevant when it comes to our discussion today. For the Rav, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, has once described what it means to be a Jew in a way that is very comparable to Crispix. The Rav noted that Avram Avinu described himself as both ger v'toshav, and the Rav said that what this means is that in every land, a Jew is both ger v'toshav, both a resident and a stranger. We are, on the one hand, a resident, a permanent resident, wholeheartedly dedicated to the development and the improvement of that society. And yet, on the other hand, we are a ger. We are a stranger. We are different. We are chosen. And every Jew lives with this dual identity, with this Crispix-like dichotomy in our existence. we are both human beings, but we are all universally, but we are also Jews. And at times, a tension exists between these two aspects of our identities. And no more so than the Jew who lives in a democratic country. And especially, I would argue, in the United States of America, speaking from my own experience. I recently read a book entitled My Love Affair with America by Norman Podhoretz. Podhoretz was for decades the editor-in-chief of the Jewish Journal Commentary, which I'm sure many of you have read, and from what you're reading from the press, is best known as one of those Jewish neoconservatives now secretly running the country. I'll say into the tape that was a joke. Now, Podhoretz opens his book by describing his attending a then heavily Gentile Columbia University and is being awarded the Khaled Fellowship, in which two Columbia students were, for which two Columbia students were chosen each year, one to attend Oxford and the other to attend Cambridge in England. In 1950, Podhoretz recounts, he was the Cambridge-bound winner, and the Oxford-bound winner was someone named Emmanuel Chill, whom, Podhoretz writes, I had never met. In those days, the Khaled was considered an important enough award to be announced in the New York Times, with pictures of the two fellows included in the story. Podhoretz continues as follows. You know, my mother said upon reading the Times piece, when I came to America, an older girl named Ida Khiel from my village was on the same ship going to join her husband, who was the son of a man named Mendel Khiel. She already knew a little English, and during the trip she taught me to say, how do you do, my dear father, so I could greet him like a regular American when we landed. Anyway, she continued, I lost touch with her after a while, but I'll bet that Emmanuel Chill is her son, named after Mendel. Now, Podhoretz listened, bemused, as his mother nattered on, saying, you know, probably this Emmanuel takes after Mendel, too, because he was very educated. He could even understand the Polish newspapers. And so he was the one we all depended on to bring us news during the war. Podhoretz writes that at this point he retorted impatiently, for God's sakes, Mom, I don't even know if the guy is Jewish. Anyway, it's too crazy. Undeterred, she announced that she was going to telephone Emmanuel Chill's mother. Don't you dare, I shouted, wrote Podhoretz, deeply embarrassed. But she dug up the number, which turned out to be listed in the phone book. And when a woman answered, my mother said, Mrs. Khiel, I'm the other mother, and I'm calling to congratulate you. After Mrs. Chill thanked her, my mother, not missing a beat, asked her if by any chance her name was Ida. And of course it was. And of course this other mother was the very same Ida Khiel with whom mine had traveled to America, Podhoretz concludes. America had found two of their sons there, plucked them up, and deposited them into a great university in which Jews were only grudgingly welcomed. To top it all off, a mere 30 years after these two young girls from a tiny hamlet in East Europe had crossed the Atlantic in steerage, America was sending their two sons back across the same ocean, only now in grand style. But Horace concludes by citing Harry Golden, who is no longer remembered, but who in the 60s wrote a bestseller, whose title unites the story with many others, Only in America. So we Jews have found tolerance and acceptance in democratic countries. We have flourished there. And like Podhoretz, Jews who live in America, at least, have responded to America's kindness by returning its affection. I think most Jews would affirm as a self-evident truth that all men are created equal. In fact, the very concept of human equality, which is the foundation of democracy, is, as I mentioned in my previous talk, based on the Hebrew Bible in the first place. And the founding fathers of the United States felt that way. As John Adams put it, the concept of human equality stems from the notion that we are equal in the eyes of God. In his words, equally accountable to the Creator for all our actions. Or, as our pasuk puts it, "Vayivra Elokim et ha'adam b'tzalmo, b'tzelem Elokim bara oto." Our sanctity stems from, our dignity derives from, the image of God that resides in every human soul and endows every human being, man and woman, with rights. So it's unsurprising that American Jews, that Jews have bought into the democratic philosophy from the very beginning. On August 17, 1790, Moses Satius, the warden of Congregation Kahal Kadosh Yeshuat Yisrael, better known as the Hebrew Congregation of Newport, Rhode Island, penned an epistle to George Washington, the first president of the United States, in which he extolled the American idea. The rabbi wrote that he beheld in the United States, quote, a government which to bigotry gives no sanction, to persecution no assistance, but generously affording to all liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship, deeming every one of whatever nation, tongue, or language equal parts of the great governmental machine, we cannot, he concluded, but acknowledge to be the work of God, who ruleth the armies of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, doing whatsoever seemeth to him good. Rabbis knew how to write English in those days. So, as the Bihar story indicates, Jews have flourished in democracy. And we have responded to that flourishing by embracing the democratic idea, the idea that all human beings are created equal and ought to be treated equally. But at the same time, as the Bihar story indicates as well, despite the extraordinary success that America has afforded us, or perhaps because of it, Jews portray a certain pride in the achievements of other Jews and of other members of the Jewish people. Alan Dershowitz, in his book Chutzpah, reports that when he first began attending Yale Law School, he glowingly reported to his mother at home in Borough Park the brilliant professors whose lectures he was attending. Goldstein, Pollack, Bekel, Skolnick, Schwartz. Then, Dershowitz writes, I told her about the most brilliant of my teachers, Calabrese. Without missing a beat, my mother asked, oh, is he an Italian Jew? Angrily, Dershowitz wrote, angrily I said, don't be so parochial. He's an Italian Catholic. Not all smart people have to have Jewish blood. Several months later, Dershowitz continues, I learned that Guido Calabrese was in fact descended from Italian Jews. I never told my mother she was right. Now I'll know if she actually reads this book. And though the Torah and the Talmud have never insisted that only Jews are intelligent or that we are smarter than everyone else, there is more than a hint of uniquely Jewish pride within our religious literature. After all, the Kiddush, which we recite every Yom Tov evening, is so seemingly immodest, it would make perhaps even Dershowitz's mother blush. Baruch ato Hashem, Elokeinu melech haolam, asher bachar bano mikol am, who has chosen us from every other nation, v'romamano mikol lashon, raised us above every other language, v'kidishanu b'mitzvosav, and sanctified us with his commandments. And these sentiments are similarly based on the Bible. V'yisem li segula mikol ha'amim, God tells Moshe on the eve of Matan Torah, you shall be for me a chosen nation and elite, am mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh, a nation of kingly priests and a holy people. So what do we believe? Are Jews equal or superior to the rest of humanity? I'm reminded of an old Russian joke in which Mikhail Gorbachev is asked to describe the Soviet economy in one word. Good, he says. Gorbachev is then asked to describe the Soviet economy in two words. Not good, he says. So we have similarly two legitimately Jewish notions. That of human equality of Tzelem Elokim on the one hand, and of Israel as the chosen nation, the Am Segula, on the other. How could we coherently deem all humanity equal in the eyes of God, and yet at the same time place Jews on the spiritual pedestal that is chosenness? So in addressing this question, I'll begin by charting how the concept of Am Segula was defined by a majority of Jewish sages, the Rishonim and the Achronim, as well as to discuss how this concept has been misused. I'll then present how many modern Jewish thinkers attempt to reconcile the Western democratic idea with that of the Am Segula. And I'll conclude by presenting my own view on how this conundrum is to be addressed. So, let's begin by asking ourselves, what does it mean to be a chosen nation? What were we chosen for? One interpretation that figures prominently in Jewish texts is that our chosenness consists in God charging Klal Yisrael with the following mission: to communicate the monotheistic message to humanity. Indeed, one of the very articulators of the democratic idea, John Adams, understood Jewish chosenness in this respect. I will insist, he once said, that the Hebrews have done more to civilize men than any other nation. Even if I were an atheist, who believed that all is ordered by chance, I should believe that chance had ordered the Jews to preserve and propagate to all mankind the doctrine of a supreme, intelligent, wise, almighty sovereign of the universe, which I believe to be the great essential principle of all morality, and consequently, all civilization. According to the Jewish tradition, this propagation of biblical doctrine of monotheism is to be accomplished in two ways. Rav Avadya Svarno, who in his commentary on Exodus explains God's description of Klal Yisrael as a nation of kingly priests, explains it as follows. Bezeh tiyu lachem segula, in this you are an elite, in this you are a chosen nation, because, he writes, you will be a nation of priests to understand and teach the entire human race so that they may call out in the name of God to serve him together. So first, Jews serve as God's monotheistic messengers to humanity, communicating the Torah's ideas to the world. Second, Jewish tradition stresses that Klal Yisrael brings God to the human race not only by engaging mankind directly, but by keeping the Torah and serving thereby as role models. Maimonides stresses that by living according to the rules of the Torah, by living a godly life, we will by example bring the Torah to the world. The Rambam's son, quoting his father, defined the term Am Segula as follows. You shall be, through observance of my Torah, leaders of the world. You shall be to them as the priest to his flock. The world will follow after you, imitating your acts and walking in your path. Now mankind, certainly, has often resisted Klal Yisrael's message and persecuted the message bearers. But in the end of days, Yeshaya tells us, the prophet Isaiah, many nations will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and V'yoreinu midrachav, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. Ki mitzion teitzei sora udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. For from Zion shall go forth thy Torah and the word of the Lord for Jerusalem. So this is apparently what Isaiah meant when he referred to the Jewish people as an or lagoyim, as a light unto the nations. God insists that through Avraham Avinu, through Abraham, all the nations of the world will be blessed. For through the Jewish people, the principles of the Torah will be spread throughout the world, thereby hastening the redemption, a messianic era in which all other nations will establish their own covenantal relationship with God. So chosenness is at least in part a gift to humanity and implies a responsibility on the part of the Jewish people. Jews are meant both by keeping the Torah and directly addressing the human race to serve as God's messengers which in the providential plan ultimately results in the redemption of the world. So according to the way these sages define the notion of an Am Segula, the concept of Klal Yisrael's election, to use a theological term, or their being chosen, implies not a disdain for the world, but rather a concern for it. So it's therefore all the more distressing when some misunderstand the concept of the chosen nation as a license to disregard the importance of the rest of the human race. I know of a Rebbe at a specific yeshiva who once had a question and answer session. I think it was a Rebbe visiting a yeshiva, had a question and answer session with the students, and one of the questions that the students raised was the following. I understand that there's a need for non-Jews in the world, but why so many? Why is the Jew to non-Jew ratio so tremendous? Now this very question, of course, is laughable, asking essentially, I know we're supposed to be a light unto the nations, but what do we need the nations for? The query brings to mind a comment by the poet W.H. Auden. We are put here on earth, Auden said, to do good to others. What the others are put here for, I cannot imagine. So this is, of course, absolutely wrong. And some have taken the notion, at times, as a statement that Jews are gifted with a specific ability to act morally. There is a story in the foreword about a recent sefer that stressed this source. But of course, if part and parcel of the providential plan is for Jews to seek and improve, to bring the message of the Bible to humanity, then that means, by definition, that all of humanity is able to adopt and to adhere to biblical monotheism. If we are meant to help ensure the morality of the world, that must mean that all of humanity, Jews and non-Jews, are all, because they are created in the image of God, gifted with the ability to freely choose to be moral. Yes, humanity has faltered, even failed in the past, and in its failure, humanity has sometimes turned on us. But our experience in America attests, and in other democratic countries, attest to the genuine goodness of the ability of human beings to act in a moral fashion. The very existence of someone such as John Adams, who in his private correspondence was so unrestrained in his admiration for the Jewish people, establishes conclusively that anti-Semitism is not something inherent in human beings. Some Gentiles can be philo-Semitic rather than anti-Semitic. That some Gentiles genuinely do want to live with Jews, telling us in the words of George Washington's response to Rabbi Sessions, may the children of the stock of Abraham, who dwell in this land, continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of other inhabitants, while everyone shall sit under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid. Indeed, the very crisis of assimilation that exists in democratic societies today attests to the openness that countries have shown the Jewish people, and again, especially in America. As one person put it, the problem for Jews used to be that Gentiles wanted to kill us. In America, the problem is that they all want to marry us. So, what are these understandings of the Am Segula, this concept that that in some way we're morally, inherently, instinctively better than other people? What is this based on? Is there anything in the halachic corpus and the vast legal literature that is the lifeblood of Orthodox Judaism that could encourage or outrightly endorse sentiments which might assume that Jews have a more inherent capacity to be moral than others? Were there any rabbis who believed that Gentiles were inherently anti-Semitic? Now, the answer is undeniably yes, but they are fewer and farther between than you would have expected. But they are there. Sources draw on Talmudic sources, statements such as Halacha l'Moshe misinai Esav sonei es Yaakov. There's a law given to Moshe at Sinai that Esau hates Jacob. And they draw on this at times to deduce non-universalistic messages, assuming that this means that everyone who's not Jewish is inherently anti-Semitic. But these statements are few and far between. And several things have to be kept in mind. The first critical thing to keep in mind is that those rabbis who wrote those statements often suffered terribly under non-Jews. And that when they were writing these things, when they looked around at the world, there was nary a moral civilization in sight. Wherever Jews were, they were persecuted. Wherever Jews were, they were suffering. Wherever Jews were, they were hated. Second, to some extent, their experience is not totally irrelevant. Anti-Semitism still exists. Anti-Semitism is real. And, as the past couple of years have indicated, virulent hatred of the Jews is not going to disappear from the world and will not disappear until the end times. The statement by the sages that it is a law of Moses that Esau hates Jacob need not and should not be interpreted as implying that all non-Jews are inherently anti-Semitic. Halacha l'Moshe misinai. Halacha l'Moshe misinai, I think, is the phrase. But okay. But it should remind us that hatred of Jews has reared its ugly head in the past and the present and will continue to do so in the future. Rabbi Yosef Blau, the Mashgiach at Yeshiva University, responding to the publication of a book which mentions some sentiments similar to ones that I just recalled, put it this way. It is possible to give the same message without ascribing evil to Gentiles and denying that they are created in God's image. One can acknowledge the intractable existence of anti-Semitism without seeing it as emanating from the essential nature of a human being. Even in the United States of America, even as late as the 1950s, anti-Semitism was rampant. Famously dramatized in Elia Kazan's bold movie, A Gentleman's Agreement, in which Gregory Peck plays a Gentile who takes on a Jewish-sounding last name in order to experience the discrimination that Jews encountered in everyday life. But Horitz, in his own book, recounts the bigotry encountered by his own family in America, telling about how his elderly Yiddish-speaking grandmother painfully studied the basics of American civics in order to prepare for her test for American citizenship. The judge, who was apparently anti-Semitic, asked this poor elderly and obviously religious Jewish woman only one question. Madam, do you believe in bigamy? Not understanding this English word and assuming that this must be one of the principles of American constitutional government, she instantly answered, sure, judge. And that was that. Her application was rejected. So concern for humanity is not the same as naivete. We cannot allow ourselves to ever use the concept of chosenness as a platform for bigotry. But nevertheless, the anti-Semitism that our ancestors have suffered at the hands of humanity, including at times in democratic countries, must remind us that hatred of the Jews will never truly disappear until the end of time. Third, what is striking about any anti-Gentile sources in the halakhic corpus is not that they exist, but that they are so few. Let's take the example for a second of Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who is the Rosh Yeshiva of Verlozhin, who lived in the end of the 19th century. Now, Rabbi Berlin writes in his commentary on the Bible many admiring things about the nations of the world and about the concept of all human beings being created in the image of God. He writes in his commentary on the Bible how Abraham righteously prayed for Sodom and how Yaakov, though he was vexed by Lavan, who intended to eradicate him, Nevertheless, he writes, Jacob spoke soft words to him. Now, where did Rabbi Berlin live when he wrote these things? Did he live in 21st century North America? No, he lived in the Pale of Europe, a place of pogroms and persecution. We quoted Rabbi Avadya Svarno's statement about the Jewish mission to humanity. When was he writing this? He wrote this at the same time when the Catholic Church burnt the Talmud. Sage after sage, in century after century, persecuted by a church whose theology consigned most of humanity, including the Jews, to eternal damnation, they themselves, even as the others spoke about them this way, the Jews themselves continue to affirm the Talmudic dictum that the righteous of all the nations of the world have a portion in the world to come. My grandfather, who himself was very opposed to the Vietnam War, took the life of every human being, my grandfather Aaron Soloveitchik, took the life of every human being so seriously that he told people, he himself, that it was better to dodge the draft than to unjustly kill a member of the Viet Cong. Now, my grandfather's brother, the Rav, who was a conservative, I got that from somewhere, the Rav was my grandfather's older brother, said about my grandfather that my brother never experienced communists. He has no idea how evil they are. And perhaps, and most people are influenced in one way or the other by their day and age. And my grandfather, who was an American, went to law school and studied constitutional law, was very, very idealistic. But what is so striking is that the idealism of centuries of rabbis doesn't seem to have been impacted by the anti-Semitic societies in which they lived. Most never assumed humanity, even as all of humanity persecuted them. Most people never assumed, most Jews never assumed, that humanity was intrinsically evil or inherently anti-Semitic. Most extraordinary is the example of Rabbi Akiva, whose flesh was flayed by the Romans, the most prominent Gentile civilization of his time, and who nevertheless left the following quote as his opening remarks in Pirkei Avos. Chaviv ha'adam shenivra b'tzelem Elokim. Beloved is man, all man, any man, for he is created in the image of God. So let's return to the question with which we began. How in the age of the democratic idea do we reconcile our chosenness with the American notion of human equality? We've argued thus far that Jews teach and serve the world in two ways, as role models through keeping the Torah, and by directly engaging the rest of humanity with their moral message. Modern Jewish thinkers draw on this notion in order to stress that it is precisely out of concern for ultimately bringing the world into a covenant with God that Jews were chosen in the first place. Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, in a response to a symposium and commentary, What Do American Jews Believe was the name of the symposium in the 1950s, wrote that the chosenness of Israel relates exclusively to its spiritual vocation embodied in the Torah. Whenever it is mentioned in our liturgy, such as the blessing immediately preceding the Shema, it is always related to Torah and mitzvot. The spiritual vocation, he wrote, consists of two complementary functions, Goy Kadosh, holy nation, and Mamlechet Kohanim, nation of kingly priests. The first term denotes, he wrote, the development of communal separateness in order to achieve a collective self-transcendence. The second term is the obligation of the brotherhood of the spiritual elite toward the rest of mankind. We are an Am Mamlechet Kohanim, a nation of kingly priests, a priesthood that is defined by the prophets as fundamentally a teaching vocation. Rabbi Emanuel Jacobovitz, once the chief rabbi of Britain, and writing this before that, also stresses the concept of the Jewish mission, but he adds, in attempting to deflect any concept of preferentialism, he adds that other nations have divinely ordained missions of their own. Yes, he wrote, I do believe that the chosen people concept is affirmed by Judaism in its holy writ, its prayers, and its millennial tradition. In fact, he writes, I believe that every people, and indeed in a more limited way, every individual, is chosen or destined for some distinct purpose in advancing the designs of providence. Only, he writes, some fulfill their missions and others do not. Maybe the Greeks were chosen for their unique contribution to art and philosophy, the Romans for their pioneering service in law and government, the British for bringing parliamentary rule into the world, and the Americans for piloting democracy in a pluralistic society. The Jews, he concluded, were chosen by God to be peculiar unto God as the pioneers of religion and morality. That is their national purpose. So Rabbi Jacobovitz downplays the notion of the Am HaNivchar, chosen nation, by stressing that all nations are, in a sense, chosen. And other sources, other respondents, including non-Orthodox respondents to the Commentary Symposium, also stress that chosenness is essentially about responsibility and mission. Someone else, I think a conservative rabbi, wrote that few beliefs have been subject to such misunderstanding as the chosen people doctrine. The Torah and the prophets clearly stated that this does not imply any innate Jewish superiority. Far from being a license for special privilege, it entails additional responsibilities not only toward God, but to our fellow human beings. It obligates us to build a just and compassionate society throughout the world, and especially in the land of Israel, where we may teach by example what it means to be a light unto the nations. And yet, while it is true that the Jews are the moral missionaries to humanity and that is an essential element of what it means to be chosen, I have become convinced that the concept of Jewish chosenness does imply something extraordinarily unegalitarian. That while all human beings are created in the image of God, all are gifted with the ability to be moral, and all beloved in the eyes of the Almighty, nevertheless, Jews, all Jews, are loved by God in a special way, unique to Jews. Now, this notion may ring harshly in our egalitarian ears, our democratic ears, but I think it's nevertheless true. Now, in order to examine this notion, I'd like to elaborate by humbly suggesting an additional part of what it means to be part of the Am Segula, what it means to be Jewish, to be chosen. I had the opportunity recently in New York to speak to a conference created by the World Jewish Congress, which was called the World Symposium of Jewish Leaders and Catholic Cardinals. And as I walked into the conference room, I was struck by the image of around 10 archbishops, cardinals, in their full cardinal regalia, red robes, skull caps, huge crucifixes hanging from their necks, mingling freely with rabbis. And I couldn't help thinking of what happened 40 years ago when Dr. Samuel Belkin, then president of Yeshiva University, met Cardinal Cushing, the Archbishop of Boston. Seeking an amicable tone, Cardinal Cushing cajoled Dr. Belkin as follows. He says, "Come, Dr. Belkin," he said, "we're essentially the same. We're both men of God. We both run large religious institutions. And most importantly, we both wear skull caps on our head." "So that's true," Dr. Belkin responded, "but there's one clear difference between us. Your skull cap is red, while your institution is financially in the black. While my skull cap is black, but my institution is very much in the red." And much has changed in the past 40 years. Yeshiva University is happily no longer in the red. The Archdiocese of Boston has had its problems of late. Now, I lead it to poskim older and wiser than myself to decide if that means we should change the color of our yarmulke. But the truth is that much more has changed than the financial health of these respective institutions. Diverse faiths and ethnicities live in America in amicable coexistence. The day before this conference, the cardinals, again in their full religious regalia, visited Yeshiva University's Beis Medrash and mingled amidst the students, cardinals and yeshiva bacharim, archbishops and aspiring rabbis, the red skullcaps bobbing amidst a sea of black, a once persecuted faith being approached by their once persecutors as equals. Truly extraordinary, and only in America moment, I think. Now, the meeting that I attended between Jewish leaders and Catholic cardinals was organized by Jean-Marie Lustiger. Now, he was the cardinal archbishop of Paris. Now, Lustiger, a loyal ally of the Pope, of the then Pope and of the current Pope, is one of the stars of the College of Cardinals. And he is also Jewish, having converted to Catholicism as a boy after his Polish-Jewish immigrant parents hid him in a Catholic boarding school during Germany's occupation of France in 1940. Meeting Cardinal Lustiger was an odd, eerie experience. He has done extraordinary good as a cardinal. He still considers himself proudly Jewish. I think he recites Kaddish every year at Auschwitz, where his mother was murdered. And when the Vatican issued a statement on the Holocaust that was deemed by many Jews to be insufficient, the Archdiocese of Paris released its own extraordinary mea culpa that was both encouraging and brave. But as I shook Cardinal Lustiger's hand, talked to him, one thought kept flashing in my head. Come back. Come back. Return to your people. At one point in the conference, we paused for mincha while the cardinals stood from afar, And again, I wanted to grasp his hand and pull him over, especially if we needed a minion. Come with us. Throw off your crucifix. Join our minion. You already have a yarmulke. And the fascinating fact is that in some sense he could have. For you see, Cardinal Lustiger is, according to the halacha, as Jewish as you or me. And though, for public policy reasons, he could not make aliyah, let's say, as a Jew under the law of return, should he want to practice Judaism, he has no need to undergo gerut, undergo conversion. In other words, though part and parcel of Jewish chosenness is bringing the Torah to the world, nevertheless, even someone who does not subscribe to Torah beliefs remains a Jew. And this unique aspect of Judaism was noted by the writer Stephen Dubner, a Jew, a writer for the New York Times, author of the current best-selling book, Freakonomics. He's a Jew whose parents converted to Catholicism and raised 9 Catholic children in upstate New York. And he wrote a book called Turbulent Souls, describing his return to the Jewish faith. An extraordinary book. I recommend it to everybody. And Dubner, in describing one of the critical moments in his return, describes meeting a man named Irving at a party. Dubner happens to mention that his parents originally hailed from Brooklyn. So he writes as follows. "You've never been back to Brooklyn?" Irving asked. "No." "Not even to visit your bubba?" "What's a bubba?" Irving blinked and scratched the top of his head. "Aren't you Jewish?" he asked. "No," I explained. "I wasn't Jewish, but my parents had been, before they became Catholic." Irving looked at me as one might look at a dog that had suddenly stood up and begun to tap dance. "Anyway, once a Jew, always a Jew," he said after a moment, chuckling, and I nodded as if I understood. But he did not understand. Dubner later expresses bewilderment at this extraordinary theological principle articulated by Irving. "What does this mean?" Dubner writes. "How could a religion be transmitted through the blood? By what right, by what bizarre law had these rabbis made me theirs?" It's a good question. Why is one's Jewishness based on descent, based on blood, rather than belief? If Cardinal Lustiger is not living a Jewish life, in what way is he still Jewish, and in what way is he still chosen? The answer appears to be that Judaism is not just a faith. It is a family. And while being part of a faith depends on one subscribing to a particular set of beliefs, family ties are inseparable. A Christian who does not believe in Christian dogma is no longer a Christian, but a Jewish cardinal remains a Jew. As the Orthodox theologian Michael Wishergrad put it, Judaism, unlike Christianity, quote, is not a set of beliefs. A full definition of Judaism does, of course, involve a whole complex of ideas, beliefs, values, and obligations posed by Judaism. But these are, he writes, in a sense, superstructure rather than foundation. The foundation of Judaism is the family identity of the Jewish people as the descendants of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Wishergrad notes how odd and seemingly unfair this is. Seen through the eyes of man, he writes, a divine election of a group defined by some ideological criterion would seem far more plausible. It would have been far more understandable had God elected all those who feed the hungry and clothe the naked, seek nirvana. But being born into a particular family is hardly an achievement, Wishergrad writes, for which anyone deserves either credit or blame. And yet being Jewish is precisely that. You are chosen, you are obligated in the Torah, if you are a descendant of Avraham Avinu. To be Jewish is to be part of a family. Why do Jews see themselves as a family? Rabbi Akiva said it himself in the very same mission in Pirkei Avos. Yes, all men are beloved, for they are created in the image of God. But then Rabbi Akiva adds, Chavivin Yisrael shenikru banim lamakom. Uniquely beloved is Israel, for they are the family of God in a special way. Banim lamakom. If all Jews are bound by family ties that remain irrevocable, then that is because we are part of God's family. The story of Judaism is not one of an impartial God randomly giving the Torah to one nation in particular. Rather, on the contrary, Judaism exists because HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, fell in love with Abraham, with Avraham Avinu, in whose merit God continues to love Abraham's children today. Why was Abraham chosen for this special mission to bring monotheism to the world? The Torah says it explicitly. Ki yedativ, for I know him and I love him. For I love Abraham, God says, because I know that he will raise his children and children's children after him to perform, and they will keep the ways of God to do justice and righteousness. The story of Judaism is of a God who falls in love with Avraham Avinu. And Avraham Avinu, who wanted to found a righteous family, and God, who loved Avraham Avinu, wanted to found that family with him, to make Avraham's children his children. To quote Visegrad one last time, if God continues to love the people of Israel, and it is the faith of Israel that he does, it is because he sees the face of his beloved Abraham in each and every one of his children, as a man sees the face of his beloved in the children of his union with his beloved. That is why Judaism is not something you can shed. Judaism is not just a belief. We are the family of Avraham Avinu, and therefore the family of God. And you cannot sever your ties to a family. It's an old story, one of the oldest Chelm stories in the book, about the rabbi of Chelm who took a trip to Warsaw. And he stayed at an inn in Warsaw. And the innkeeper in Warsaw was talking to the rabbi, and he said to him, you know what, I have a riddle to tell you. The rabbi was always looking for some good riddles. Rabbis always looking for something to use in their speeches. So the innkeeper, he said, oh, please tell it to me. So the innkeeper says to the innkeeper from Warsaw, said to the rabbi of Chelm, I know somebody who's the son of my father and my mother, but he's not my brother. Who do you think it is? So the rabbi of Chelm thinks it over. He says, I have no idea. Who is it? So the innkeeper of Warsaw says, it's me. So the rabbi says, this is a tremendous riddle. He goes home, you know, gets up to the pulpit to give a sermon. And he says, ladies and gentlemen of Chelm, I have a tremendous riddle. I know somebody who's the son of my father and my mother, and he's not my brother. Who is it? So all of Chelm says, I don't know. Who is it? So the rabbi says, it's the innkeeper from Warsaw, of course. So the fact is, family is defined. Family is not something that can be magically transferred. You cannot shed who your brother is. You cannot shed who your father is. You cannot do that. Once you are part of the Jewish family, you remain part of the Jewish family. And part of being chosen is being part of the family of Avraham Avinu. Indeed, the very concept of Geirut, as we understand it, of conversion to Judaism, is not just taking on a set of beliefs, but actually in some mystical and miraculous way that we cannot quite understand, actually forging yourself onto the physical Jewish family. You are not only someone who keeps the Torah, although you have to be that too. You are a Ben Avraham Vesara. You are a child of Abraham and Sarah. That is what Judaism means. You not only take a conversion to Judaism, you not only take on beliefs, you take on a whole new familial existence. It is no coincidence that Rus, the archetypal convert to Judaism, when speaking to Naomi, said, Amecha mi, your people will be my people. Not only Elokai Echa Elokai, your God is my God. Every Jew is a child of Avraham Avinu, and therefore uniquely beloved by God, who sees the face of his beloved Abraham on the face of every Jew. And I would add, just as a parent loves his or her child, whether or not the child deserves it, so too a Jew remains part of this family, whether or not he is keeping to his mission. Devarim says as follows, Lo merubchem chashak Hashem bachem. Not because of merubchem, which can be translated as your greatness in population or your greatness in other things. So the Torah is the text delineating the dreams God has for his Jewish children. But a parent whose hopes have been dashed continues to feel that familial bond to his or her children, nonetheless. And it's with this in mind that Jews are, in some special way, the family of God, that a fascinating facet of Jewish law can be understood. Jewish status, whether one is chosen, whether one is a member of the Jewish people, depends not on who one's father was, but rather on who one's mother was. One whose mother's 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 mother is Jewish, even if his or her other ancestors were not Jewish. Now this is striking for two reasons. First, in Jewish law, no other personal status is determined by the mother. Whether one is a Kohen or a Levi, whether one belongs to the tribe of Yehuda or Yisachar, follows one's father. Second, what's fascinating is that at the time when this rule was stated explicitly in the Gemara, and as an Orthodox Jew, I believe that this goes further back than that, all the Gentile societies to never look to the mother for anything important. Anything. Harvard's Professor Shaya Cohen writes that throughout the ancient world, the parent who mattered was, of course, the father. The children born of a mother were his children, not the mother's. But the rabbis, incredibly, insisted that the mother and only the mother mattered. And this, I think, can be understood based on something that Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik noted, that God in the Nevi'im and the prophets is called not only the father, but also the mother of Klal Yisrael. When why, for a mother, the Rav explained, always sees her child, no matter how old he is, as the baby she once gave birth to. In his words, the mother can never forget the biological fact that her child was once a part of her, that she gave him her blood, and she brought him into the world with suffering and pain. When she says, "My baby," writes the Rav, she means to say, "Once we were one body, I gave you life." For the mother, the Rav writes, no matter how old and independent the latter, the baby is, the image of the baby, the memory of an infant held in her arms, the picture of herself playing, laughing, embracing, nursing, never vanishes. And upon having children, I myself have found that that's true. When my eldest son was born, I saw how my wife fiercely gathered my son, Aharon, to herself. And you realize at that point that that child will always be her baby, no matter how much he grew. And at that point, I remembered my own bar mitzvah haftorah, in which Israel, having sinned and lost the temple, frets that Azavani Hashem, v'Hashem shechechoni. God has left me, he has forgotten me. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu replies, HaTishkach isha ula merachem ben vitna. Can a woman forget her baby, refrain from having mercy on the fruit of her womb? Gam elas ishkachna, as she can forget, she cannot forget, so too I cannot. Judaism follows the mother because part and parcel of being chosen is being part of a family. And God relates to us like a mother. God can look at a Jew whose life has been so disappointing and still see the child that once was. God can look at the Jewish Archbishop of Paris who has chosen crosses over kippot, baptisms over brises, and masses over minyanim, and still see that Jewish baby whose parents brought him into this world with so much hope for the future, the baby at whose bris was pronounced by his parents with so much love, Keshem shenichnas labris, kein yikones latorah l'chupa l'masim tov. So we come then to the nub of the third approach, my own humble approach, in reconciling the concept of Tzelem Elohim, image of God on the one hand, and chosen nation on the other. Jews can and should affirm the concept of equality, that our Creator endows all men with the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Every human life is created in the image of God. Every human life is accountable to its Creator, as John Adams said, for good and ill. All human beings are given the extraordinary opportunity to choose the good and to earn a portion in the world to come. That's all true. All human beings, in that sense, truly are created equal. But God does not relate equally to all nations and love everybody in the same way. He will, according to the prophets, in the Messianic age, when every nation establishes their own unique covenantal love with God, loving covenant with God. But he has a special, maternal, I would say, love for the Jewish people. And I would just add, in conclusion, that it is this notion of God's love for the Jewish people that preserved us for centuries when we were not loved by anyone else. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has a story that he once had a Holocaust survivor. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the Rosh Yeshiva of Gush Etzion, had a Holocaust survivor over at his house. And someone else, who considered themselves an intellectual, asked this Holocaust survivor where God was when this person was suffering in the Holocaust. And the survivor looked right back at this person who asked the question and said, "Erez geven mit uns." He was with us. Now, not everyone who has gone through the Holocaust has responded in this way, nor am I saying they should. But the fact is, that if Jews were able to make it through centuries of persecution without hating everyone else and without taking the picture that anti-Semites had painted, without taking that picture as accurately depicting themselves, if they were able to survive and keep their own self-esteem, it was because of this notion of a God who loved the Jewish people and who suffered with the Jewish people. The concept of the Shechina Begalusa, the concept of the God who is in a certain sense the mother of Klal Yisrael, and who continues to love them and support them. So we as Jews do embrace democracy, and we celebrate democracy, and we celebrate the notion of human equality. But we also must remain true to our theological tradition of the concept of the Jews as being inseparably part of the family of Abraham, in whose merit God loved the Jewish people, and in whose merit God will continue to love the Jewish people for generations to come. Thank you very much.